He might know.
He knows it. It's like part of the DLC. He's in
He might know.
Well, so let's start it out with a seminar, and it's my pleasure to announce practically our own data priest. He's going to tell us today about new and expanded approaches to quantum error correction.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for the invitation. Oh, right. So I brought my own files. So I noticed this one's broken. Okay, so we... Yeah, so I'm going to talk about this work with joint work with Ray and David Blumen and my student Maya Lozowski, who's actually later this week just got her master's at Guelph, mainly based on this work. And so here's where I'll go. So you know, a very short introduction and discussion about evolution of quantum systems, and then the basic methods, the fundamental methods for the error for quantum error correction, and in particular the error correction of quantum operations. Okay, and so this I think to pretty much everyone in the audience, the first three sections there will be pretty much review, but it'll at least allow me to set the stage for the rest of the talk. So then I'll get into generalized notion of noise of subsystems and this unified approach, as we're calling it, operator quantum error correction. And then talk about some of the, get into a little more to the mathematics, and talk about conditions on error models for correction in this method. Okay, so introduction to standard setup, right? So you've got for every quantum system, you'll have a Hilbert space, and so quantum computing, the ones we're focusing on at least for now, are quantum dimensional. And so for example, C2, you've got a two-level quantum system, 0 and 1, and then your quantum bits of information are linear combinations of the two base states, and then that will lead to a natural orthonormal basis for n-qubit space, or 2 to the n-dimensional Hilbert space. And right, and so evolution of quantum systems, and so I guess I mean here, you know, a sort of a snapshot of the evolution of a quantum system. There's sort of the two perspectives. First is evolution in a closed quantum system, and from the vector perspective, evolution in a closed quantum system corresponds to, So if you've got a vector in your system Hilbert space, then evolution in closed quantum system means that the vector is going to evolve to some unitary acting on the vector. So that's the vector perspective. At the level of operators, it's maybe a little more convenient. Obviously, I'm biased, but easier to get a handle on things when you look at things from the operator perspective, because there are natural maps around on operators. So in particular, this sort of equation at the level of operators translates to an operator or a density operator, generally we'll be focusing on, evolves to conjugation by U and U deck. Okay? Right, and so as I said, this leads to maps on operators, very natural maps on operators that you can call, that are also called super operators. And so they're going to go from, of course, you can focus on density operators, but why not just open up the whole can of worms and allow yourself to look at it on any old operator, and it's actually, in general, it's easier to do that. And so B of H then is going to be the notation for all the operators on H. And so the super operator in this case, determined by unitary, is E. So E of rho is equal to U rho U deca. Okay. So in open quantum systems, of course, things are different. And sort of the standard picture is this situation where you've got your system of interest, and it's an open quantum system, and you regard it as a piece of a larger closed quantum system. And so the larger closed quantum system the Hilbert space there is going to be the tensor product of the system Hilbert space together with some environment. And so from an evolution standpoint, you're going to have some interplay between the system and the environment that you have to deal with. And so mathematically, this is what evolution maps look like in the setting of an open quantum system. Okay, so what do you need? Well, if you're looking at an evolution map on your system Hilbert space, all right, thinking of it as a superoperator, it's going to have to be a positive map and also trace preserving, okay? Because you need probabilities to be preserved, right? You need density matrices supported on the system space to go to density operators. But you also need that when you regard your evolution map as acting on the larger system as sort of a piece of a quantum operation, and sort of the natural way to think of that is as the you need the same, or in other words, you need the identity tensor to be positive and trace preserving for any environment, for any choice of E, right? And I say you need, and I guess there's some recent controversy on exactly what you need, but I think the standard is still that you want your maps to be completely positive and trace preserving at this point.
The controversy is maybe you need more.
Maybe you need more. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's less. It's maybe just different to this.
Yes, let's get it off.
Well, they're right. So there's been a few papers recently where your maps aren't they have a Krauss decomposition. Okay, that I'm about to get to, but the noise operators depend on the on a state that you start with, so it's not. I guess it's not linear. Maybe.
Yeah, not linear. Well, we can pay a lot for private things.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You can break the competitive data.
Yeah.
Very good.
Then you can have private things in the environment, not direct product. And then you start unitary evolution of the entire system. Reduce the density of something that you possible.
Right.
I mean, it's not even not just linear. It's not a map. I mean, it doesn't depend on just the state.
Well, when I say map, I mean linear.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not a function. It's not.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Maybe function on some domain, which is less than the entire domain of density metrics. We should know the correlation.
It depends. It depends on something that's outside the system itself, right?
Yes.
So there's obviously controversy there.
But
there's some assumption that Markovian here is that assumption.
Well, I mean, I'm just okay. So I'm just looking at a snapshot, I guess, sort of a discrete. Snapshot of the evolution of the system. So it's just going to be. So you're asking if there's like a time variable involved.
Well, some memory.
You want to see it? Yeah. Well,
it's probably doing quantum computation, so there are many evolution steps.
That's right. Yeah. So this is. I guess you could say this is sort of a discrete snapshot that I'm talking about. Okay. So. Anyway, I'm going to make this standard assumption so there, the definition is on the board, and argue with it now. So a quantum operation, or a quantum channel, or quantum evolution, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to take to be a completely positive trace preserving map. Okay, so, or superoperator.
Linear.
Linear, and that follows from the theorem. So one of the nicest sort of structured theorems for these objects is this theorem of depending on who you talk to, due to Choi or Krauss, and it's basically says that every completely positive map has the meat of the theorem is that every completely positive map has this decomposition, this operator sum decomposition it's called. So there are operators on the space for which this map has this form. The operators are not going to be unique. There are lots of choices, but there is sort of uniqueness when you dig down deep enough. There is some uniqueness associated with the choice, in particular the level of operator algebras. There's a uniqueness that maybe we'll come up with later. But anyway, then once you have a map of this form, it's easy to see that trace preservation is equivalent to that condition being satisfied. Okay, so you could take that as, if you like, as the definition of CP trace preserving maps, at least on finite dimensional space. Right, and so the AIs then, we're going to think of as the errors, all right? So they're the errors or noise operators. They're the things you have to correct for if you're thinking of this describing some sort of transmission of quantum information or something, right? So you've got to correct for these operators. And so in the case where you're just looking at a unitary channel, of course, I mean, it's just trivial to correct for it. I mean, you can correct for anything. So any row goes to U row, U dagger. So there's some rotation or something that this channel produces, your recovery is just simply conjugating that by doing the reverse math. But of course, you know, in general, you're going to have things much more complicated. So how do you deal with things? And well, there's a number of different groups that kind of came to the sort of the same realization. What we're going to call now the standard model for quantum error correction, sort of in the mid to late 90s. And so the setup is that. So a code that is going to be a subspace of your system Hilbert space, all right? And then the definition, very natural definition, in this setting, given your error model E, so you're going to say a code subspace C is correctable for E exactly when there is an R, okay, a quantum operation, R, CP trace preserving, which undoes the effects of E, okay, on C. In other words, for every row that's supported on C, so from a matrix perspective, it's all the rows that only have non-zero entries possibly in that in the corner, the matrix corner corresponding to C. So there's the definition of being correctable, and so the standard model then consists of these triples, right? R, E, and C. And a simple point that'll come into play later. You could interpret this all in terms of vectors, but why not say the level of operators? And instead of thinking of C, well, it's equivalent. What I'm saying is it's equivalent to think of C or the operators that act on C. Right? So I mean, it's go back and forth between either perspective. And here's a very simple example. So it's on C4, you've got the span of 0011 and two error operators, two noise operators, and the second one is the polymatrix X on the first qubit. And you just compute that if you look at X1 on C, you get that subspace C1, and you can just write down a correction operation R that corrects for E on C. And this is a very simple example, but somehow it's somehow typical what's going on here. Namely, the prototypical example of a correctable code happens when you have your code subspace and you have error operators. So say there are two of them, which take that subspace to two subspaces that are perpendicular to each other. Okay, and for instance. When the two error operators are multiples of unitary operators, okay, which map them to orthogonal spaces, and then there's a prescription for actually building this constructive correction operation. You can actually just write down the correction operation R. It does the trick. Okay, and so the very nice theorem proved by two of those groups that I had on the previous slide, so Nilofen and Bennett, DiVincenzo, Smolin, and Wooters, is that a code subspace C is correctable for an error model E if and only if, okay, there is a scalar matrix, lambda, for which this identity is satisfied, this operator identity is satisfied for any choice of I and J. Okay? In that prototypical example I told you about, when your channel is a convex sum of unitaries, and each of the unitaries map the space C perpendicular subspaces. Your matrix lambda is going to be diagonal. It's going to be a diagonal matrix. And in the previous example, that's exactly what's going on there. And you can just compute that lambda is going to be that matrix, 1/2, 1/2. In general, lambda, I guess the only complete restriction you can place on lambda is that lambda will always be positive. Right? These relations being satisfied, it's a little trick to see that your matrix lambda will always be a positive matrix. So of course, in general, that means it won't be necessarily diagonal. But
PC and the last slide, that was the projector onto the subspace C.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so that's an important point. It's going to come up later. So when I, So PC is the projection of the big Hilbert space onto the code subspace. Right. Okay. So that's what we're calling the standard model. And so now on the noise of subsystems and decoherentry subspace. Okay. So this is now. By some these are regarded as two separate methods of error correction, but I think it's more realistic to, it's maybe more appropriate to think of them as bundled up as one method of error correction, and namely sort of the fundamental passive method of error correction, or method of passive error correction in quantum computing. And so there's, as you can see, a lot of names associated with the initial development of this.
A quick question. In the definition of error correction, you've got that sort of an inverse CP map.
Right.
If you relaxed and didn't require that inverse map PCP, would things actually be different or not?
Well, just on the surface, I would say yeah. I mean, it gives you more freedom, except I guess the what I sort of take as the thinking is that you sort of what you do has to be allowed by the laws of quantum mechanics, I guess, and I guess that goes back to the definition of quantum operation, right? So R has to be quantum operation. So if you're going to adjust that definition, then you could adjust the error correction schemes, I suppose.
It seems plausible that if any inverse exists, then there might always exist a CP inverse, and in that case, detecting whether the code is correctable is simply a matter of making sure that certain things aren't in the kernel of the map.
Right. I'm not sure. That might be true when you're cutting down. So in other words, like positive, like when you make enough restrictions, positive may imply completely positive.
I think at least some stuff will be different. I mean, it depends. It depends what kind of inverses you're going to allow, I guess. But for instance, you have a discrete set of errors.
Right.
Of possible errors, it should always be possible to come up with an encoding for which those errors will just happen to take you to different states. But they won't be distinguishable quantum mechanically, they won't be orthogonal states, but if you're allowing a nonlinear map, you could still look at it in a very...
Well, I didn't mean nonlinear maps.
So positive, but not completely positive.
No, that's
just linear. Because it's blindly.
Not necessarily even linear. Not necessarily even positive.
Yeah. What I meant is simply that if it is the case that any linear inverse implies a CP inverse, then that would make it much easier to detect whether you have an error correcting code, because it's then just a question of whether certain things are in the kernel.
It's already very easy because those conditions he said there.
I mean, the conditions are tested. I mean, you just
have to
test. If you have an error model, right, in your subspace, you just have to crank through the computation. I'm going to keep going through it. It'll come up again in the general. This is all reviewed. So.
Actually, let me ask you a question. Yep. Is that a constructive method or just an existence?
The correction?
Yeah.
The active correct, it's actually constructive. It's level. You can actually explicitly write down the R. Yeah. So if you know, yeah. So if you know E and C, you can write down the R. Okay, so move on now to, so the noise is subsets and feature and tree subspaces, right? And so, as I said, they're regarded, I think, by some as sort of separate methods, but it's natural to regard them as part of the same method. And you can do that by looking at the operator algebras that are sort of in the air here, okay? And so first of all, so if we have our error model, then if you look at the algebra generated by the noise operators, and often it's going to be automatically self-adjoint, but let's just throw in the daggers to make it self-adjoint. So it's the CSER algebra generated by the AIs, and this is called the this is the interaction algebra associated with the error model.
Yeah. Well, what does it mean, the algebra generated? Yeah.
Okay. So it's in this case, it's going to be all the polynomials in the AI and AI daggers as your variables. And in fact, from sort of standard minimal polynomial linear algebra tricks, Cayley-Hamilton theorem can show that it's actually going to be all the polynomials up to a uniform upper bound of degree. So you're only going to have to go up to a fixed degree polynomial level to get everything. So it's all the polynomials in these variables, if you like. Okay, all the complex polynomials in those variables. And then the noise commutant for this interaction algebra is the set of all things, all operators that commute with the AI and AI dagger, and it's often going to be automatically self-adjoint. The daggers are going to be automatically in there for free, often. So strictly speaking, it's all the row that commute with the AIs and the AI daggers. I guess row means density matrix too, so that's implicit from that equation. Anyway, So sort of the fundamental point that I think that drives these investigations into noisy subsystems, decoherence-free subspaces, is that things in the noise commutant are immune to noise of the channel, to the errors of the channel, at least in the case of unital channels. Okay, so the unital channel means the identity evolves to the identity. Whoops, it's a LaTeX error. So it's E of the identity is equal to the identity, right? So in the case of unital, and so here's why, all right? So I mean, it wasn't written in this perspective, but this is exactly what's going on. If you have something in the noise commutant, just compute, and E of rho is equal to rho. So in the case of unital channels, the being in the noise commutant implies that you're fixed by the channel. So the unital constraint, if you look in the literature, really isn't emphasized too much, and mainly that's because they really wasn't a concern, because the channels that were motivating their investigation were actually unitary. So for instance, when you have a channel that's a convex sum of unitary operators, it's automatically a unital channel. Okay. I'll come back to that unital and non-unital business later. Well, the point is, yes. So in fact, the converse of this is true in the case of the unital channel. The fixed point set, the set of things that are immune to the noise of the channel, is actually equal to the noise commutant. Okay. And so, as a finite dimensional C-star algebra, there's a very tight structure theory of finite dimensional C-star algebras, and in particular, they're all unitarily equivalent. Okay, you can get a big unitary U conjugate the algebra to get these this matrix form. Okay, so what I mean by this is the direct sum of blocks, block matrix algebras, where in each block you've got the nk by nk matrices sort of ampliated, repeated nk times. Okay. So So what is that? So what's going on in terms of these noisy subsystems from this perspective? Well, it just means simply that if you have something supported on one of these blocks, so it's the identity tensor, it's the MK by NK identity tensor, something in an NK by NK matrix, then it's going to be fixed by E. And let's drop the secondary index, K, all right, to focus more and to link with what I'm going to talk about next. So what this is saying then is that if you have something, an M by N matrix, then rho naught, and you tensor it with the M by N identity, then E of that thing is equal to that thing, And so in particular, I can have the identity channel there, and that's not going to affect things. Okay? So this is sort of a clue to towards linking this with the more general setup and the standard model for error correction. Right? So this is, in this case, the easy way to think of it is that your correction operation is the identity channel. Okay? And so you can take this as a definition, then, if you like, a definition of standard noise of subsystems and decoy entropy subspaces, a unifying definition. You get decoy entropy subspaces in this definition when you're really looking at you don't have any repeats here. You really are looking at a bona fide matrix block. In other words, you can really identify it with its subspace. Okay, in that case. Right. Okay, so that's noise of subsystems. Before I get into the generalized version, there's some. A little bit of mathematics that I want to talk about, because this will come up later. If we focus on one of these blocks, right, the commutant of that is YM tensor MN. It's going to be MM tensor IN. Okay, and such an algebra contains a family of matrix units. Okay? You can always get them. So just to grasp onto something, in the case where M and N are both equal to 2, so it's phi 2 tends to the 2 by 2 matrices, what I mean by this is once your bases have been chosen, there's going to be four matrices, right? So this is going to be P11 is going to correspond to the matrix 1, 0, 1 in the 1-1 position and 0, 0, 0, tensored with the 2 by 2 identity matrix. And similarly for the other three matrix units that generate. So they're going to be inside M2 tensor I2. In fact, they generate it as an algebra, or as a vector space. And they're also going to be in the commutant of that thing. Okay. So, generalized noise of subsystems. Okay. So to begin with, let's assume we have a decomposition. Your Hilbert space is going to decompose as a direct sum of some space, direct sum with two subsystems, HA tensor HB. HB is where the noiseless stuff is going to be encoded. Okay, so that's coming up in the definition. So I've changed the notation slightly, but let me just link back with standard noise of subsystems, at least in the case of when E was unital, as I was talking about before, right? In that case, the important equation there looks like this, right? Anything in that matrix block, say sigma b now, tensored with the identity on A, you're asking that this thing evolves to the identity tensor sigma b. So you're acting for this precise evolution of this thing. But really, the important point here is that this whatever you have on the B system evolves to the same thing, right? Like that's the noiseless component. So really, you don't care what's going on this first tensor slot, and that leads to this generalized definition, which I'll sort of include as part of this lemma. So these three conditions are equivalent. Okay, this if and only if this, if and only if this, and this is going to be the definition of HB being a generalized noise subsystem for an error map E. Okay? So the important sort of general form of this equation to think of is this one. Okay, this first equation. So what's going on here is that your sigma, right? I mean sigma A tensor sigma B evolves to some tau A tensor sigma B, the point being that it doesn't matter what's here to begin with and what's here to end with, as long as you're able to preserve what's going on the second slot, on the HB tensor slot. And then these three conditions show that really, at least on this end, it's enough to actually focus on the identity. The identity there. So you can do it for the identity, it falls for all of them. And in fact, in a sense, you can focus on, in a sense that I'll make precise later, you can focus on the what's going on here, at least in the general error correction context. Okay. And this last condition is this notation, this is a lovely Gothic A, and that doesn't define what it is, but that's what the script is. And so there's two things there I'll define in a couple of slides. Okay, but that's not fair. But anyway, you'll see it again. So a simple example to show you that there really is there really is different stuff going on here, right? In particular, this generalized definition allows you to consider noisy subsystems for non-unital channels. Okay? So, for instance, if you take the what's known as the spontaneous emission channel, right? So it's going to have two noise operators. One is just the projection onto to the zero state, and the second one sends one to zero. Okay, so it's spontaneous emission of your energy state, of your excited energy state down to the ground state. And as your second quantum operation, just take any arbitrary quantum operation with a noisy subsystem, standard noisy subsystem, right? So standard noisy subsystem. And then if you take the tensor product of these two things and let it act on the larger states, then HB is going to be a generalized noisy subsystem, but not for E, but not a standard, okay? Because what happens is your map, well, you just compute, you get rho tensor sigma, where sigma is supported on the noisy subsystem, evolves to this operator tensor sigma, and the point is that you've got something else here, and the main sort of overlying point here is that this channel, spontaneous emission channel, you can just compute, it's not a unital channel. And it's not a unital channel. And in fact, this class of examples works for instead of spontaneous emission, if you just take any old channel, not necessarily unital, you could build a class of such examples. So they're mathematically, it's a bit cooked up, but on the other hand, it's not, I think, sort of natural physically, because this is the sort of situation you come up with when you're, when your system of interest is part of a composite system, right? You have to think, yeah.
So it doesn't really matter what the first operator is, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly, yeah. So it's, I've just given spontaneous emission just to give us an explicit, simple example. But this class of examples works for any arbitrary channel can work on the first tensor cell.
So in the example at the bottom, the Hilbert space you're working with in the end has three factors?
In this case, oh yeah, right. Yes. So in other words, K. There's this space K that I'm ignoring. Yeah. So H. Yeah. HB is contained in H. So it's gonna have an orthogonal complement.
Okay. It's simply subspace.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So there's an example, and it's sort of a classic example. Now this notation comes up. And if you look back to that previous lemma, I'm going to restate it in more general form in a little while. But remember that one of the points there was that these tensors, these operator tensors, play a key role there, right? And if you just think of this set of operators, okay, so you have a particular tensor decomposition. If you look at all operators that have such a form, it's not an algebra in general, but it's not an operator algebra, but it is a semigroup. It's an operator semigroup. You can multiply two things in there, and you're still in there, right? So it's a semigroup, and that previous lemma suggests considering this thing. And so here's some more notation. So this is now a general family of matrix units, okay? So I'm going to assume that, so it's like it agrees with my slides back where I had IM tensor MN, right? I had M-dimensional space to N-dimensional space. A is going to be the first tensor slot, it's dimension M. B is the second tensor slot, it's going to be dimension N. And so you're going to have these matrix units, right, that belong to this algebra, in other words, the commutant of IB tensor, or sorry, IA tensor B of HB, okay? And then this operator, so I don't want to focus too much on this. It comes into play, but we're going to get lots of technicalities if I go too deep in it. But P subscript A is going to be the projection onto this subspace. So remember your whole space decomposes as this thing directs on its perf. Okay, so P subscript A is going to be the projection of the whole space onto this thing. Okay, and then your script P of A is just going to be the compression map. Takes an operator and it compresses to the matrix form corresponding to this subspace. Okay, So,
can you explain that in compression math?
Compression math, yeah. So in other words, it takes an operator.
Oh, well, you're sandwiching between those things, right? That's kind of the idea.
Yeah. So it takes. So it takes an operator, and it multiplies it on both sides by the same projection. So this is equivalent to, in the matrix picture, it's equivalent to sort of looking at just as just a matrix corner corresponding to that subspace. So that's going on. And you have to have it around just to deal with the fact that your whole space may not be this tensor file. And just have, it's just sort of a technical thing you have to deal with. So, very nice theorem here. We can characterize exactly when you have a noisy subsystem. In other words, when one of these semigroups A and one of these semigroups A encodes a noisy subsystem for a given map. So as in the definition from a few slides ago. So it happens exactly when these two conditions hold. Okay. This condition down here, again, this is the technicalities of things. It just means that subspace that I was talking about, the matrix corner subspace, it is invariant for the noise operators. Yeah, that's what that's saying. And this is sort of the more interesting one. You need that condition to hold. Okay, so it means, this is an if and only if, right? These two things coincide. And so in particular, it says that the EIs, with respect to this decomposition, they have to have an explicit form, right? Here and here, you can have whatever, not anything. There are going to be relations determined by trace preservation, things like that. The important thing, though, is for the noisy subsystem business, you need this matrix, this index by KL, where you've got scalar multiples of the identity on B, okay, and then the invariance of that subspace gives a zero there. Okay, so from a matrix perspective, it gives a very explicit form that these things have to have. Okay. So I guess I've now described the fundamental the standard model and for quantum error correction and the standard methods of noisy subsystems and also decoherence-free subspaces, and now this generalized method of noisy subsystems. And now they can, and here we'll see that they can all be regarded as parts methods under the same umbrella. Okay, this unified approach that we're calling operator quantum error correction. Justification for that is simply that the codes in this setting take the form of operator semigroups and operator algebras. Okay. So what is it consist of? Well, basically you have triples again. Okay, so R and E are going to be the same as before. They're quantum operations on the same D of H, and A is now going to be a semigroup of B of H. Defined as above, right, with respect to that fixed decomposition, and so motivated by the standard model, we'll just say that a triple is that semigroup is correctable for E exactly when this condition holds. All right, so it's again, this is here for technical reasons. I mean, the important point is that you're tracing over A, so you're getting something in B, and basically it's saying that the evolution is not going to affect what's going on the B system. Okay, that's what it's effectively saying there. And to be explicit, this definition means that and this is what it should mean, right? You're going to have a correctable triple if the B sector, the HB sector of the semigroup encodes a generalized noisy subsystem for the composition map. I mean, that's the way it's got to work out.
You say it's correctable.
Yeah.
R is the correctness in some sense. So
yeah,
it's actually corrected. It's not only.
Your
system includes the correction.
Yeah. Well, the trip. I mean, just mathematically, it's most clean just to think of things in terms of triples. But yeah, typically the situation you're going to be having is you're going to be given your error model. It's going to be a relative equivalent or something like that, and you're going to be searching for these correctable code subspaces, and once you have those two things, then you're going to build your correction operation. But it's we think of it in terms of triples because you need those three things to make things go.
This seems a surprisingly weak-looking statement.
In what sense?
But it's just checking that the traces are the same.
No, it's saying, it's saying more, right? I mean, think of that general equation. You have a sigma A tensor sigma B evolves to something, right? And this is demanding.
Wait a minute, that's a partial trace.
It's a partial trace. Yeah, partial trace, yeah.
Right.
So it's saying that, you know, for instance, it's saying something like sigma A tensor sigma B has to evolve to, under R composed with B, it has to evolve to like tau A tensor sigma B. What happens on the B system doesn't change. Or at least when you compose with R, you get back to where you started. Let me turn to the next slide to help things out a bit. Because with this theorem, what I've just done is just taken the lemma from a while back and just in place of E, I've just replaced E by R composed with B. Okay? Because this is the definition is that to be correctable means that it means that A has to encode a generalized noise subsystem for R composed with E.
What was the conclusion in the lemma again?
It was exactly this statement with no R's.
Yeah, but what was the?
The conclusion,
conclusion is just that they are equivalent.
If all conditions are equivalent. Yeah. So this is, take away that first condition and remove the R's from all of these, and that was that lemma, the defining lemma of generalized noise subsystem.
The original noise thing, could you call that a correctable thing that doesn't need correction? I mean, it's already corrected.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's sort of the situation where, if you want to think in terms of triples, where your R is the identity channel. Yeah.
Might be appropriate to call the triple a corrected code rather than correctable.
Well, you have to talk to one of the grandmasters.
The assumption here is that you have to do the R part by hand, right? So it's not like the system is naturally doing that for you.
So there are different perspectives. You could also, mathematically, you could also think of the triple as sort of given to you mathematically, and you can investigate different relationships between the possible R's, B's, and C's. But physically, you want to think of your R as something you're doing to.
Yeah, and but I mean, if the R is part of your data, it's corrected. If the R is not, then it's corrected.
No. Look, I mean, if somebody gives you an error correction code and says you encode it this way and you have to do this to correct it, you're given data there. You're told how to do it, but the physical system doesn't do it. You have to do that yourself. Now, you have to think of this not just as mathematics, but as something that you're supposed to be doing. Physically. And physically, it's not corrected by itself. You have to do that.
Yeah, but it's coming with a book of directions on how to correct it.
That's right, of course. as it could.
But it's not done by itself. Compared to the previous, before it was not generalized, you did not have to apply this R. And then there was just the R was identity. So there it was. Indeed, corrected.
Yeah. If someone gives you a book of
I guess my recollection of what he said at the beginning is wrong. I remember the definition having an R in it.
That was a standard line.
Okay.
But R could be the identity in this generalized context, and in this unified approach, R could be the identity and the identity channel. And in fact, that's precisely when you're really looking at a noiseless subsystem. This is kind of silly. So.
And we're just trying to explain at least that historically there was a logic of calling it.
Yeah, okay, I want to move on to some. I'll have to move. So I want to show you some more of the mathematics.
You had something about this. The code was now a very generalized thing, it was just a semi group. Is there some structure theorem for that?
Well, that's actually a good mathematical question, actually, that if you look at it, we're looking at very specific operator semigroups. So it sort of raises the question as to whether, because there are lots of, you know, there's a whole subfield of operator theory on people studying operator semigroups. So you have to wonder whether there's corresponding error correction schemes for those as well. Yeah, so here's, and just to kind of give a very simplistic view on how all these different cases sit inside this unified approach, right? So the standard model sits inside it when your semigroup is a subspace, by subspace I really mean the subspace identified with the operators that act on the space. Okay. The generalized noisy subsystems sit inside when, as we talked about, when R is the identity channel, and just thinking of the triples, and when R is the identity channel and A is actually an algebra, you can regard standard noisy subsystems as subcase of this approach, and similarly, degeneracy-free subspaces when you actually are looking at the case of when the algebra really is, it's not empty, it really is just a full matrix block without any repeating.
Is the generalized noisy subsystem case actually a generalization of the standard noisy subsystem case? I mean,
yes.
In the sense that with the standard one, can you always extend A to be an algebra and have the same, everything else the same?
Well, it's just on its surface it's different, right? Because you're asking that on its surface, you're asking, you're not, you know, standard noisy subsystems, you're asking that, what does the equation look like? Identity tensor rho must evolve to identity tensor rho. The equation for the generalized noisy subsystems becomes a sigma tensor rho evolves to taus tensor rho. Right, so just on the surface, it's different, but there's also other reasons, like technically. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean,
okay, so maybe I'm misremembering the definition. Never mind.
There's something that will come up shortly that maybe we'll, on this slide, actually. So conditions for correction. Well, all right, so I talked about the condition for noisy subsystems, and there's some more sort of conditions you can get. So for instance, there is this, so in our semigroup, remember it looks like all things sigma A tensor sigma B, that's a semigroup, but there is this distinguished operator algebra inside there, right? It's the one that, where sigma A is the identity on A, right? So it's a Caesar algebra sitting inside your semigroup, and somehow it's a bit distinguished on the, just by looking at it, and in fact it turns out that correcting a semigroup is actually equivalent to the precise correction of the this sort of distinguished algebra. Okay, so it's a theorem, a little bit to prove that in other words, a semigroup is correctable for E if and only if there is a correction operation, a quantum operation R, for which R corrects the behavior of E precisely on this subalgebra. Okay, so there exists an R. I mean, so you know there exists an R from the by the definition of correctable code. Okay, but the point is you can build another R. If you have such an R, you can build another R that actually corrects this distinguished subalgebra precisely. Okay, so and actually it's an if and only. Okay, so even though this whole scheme we're focusing on semigroups, and you should, semigroups are more general than operator algebras. If you actually want to go and correct something, it's equivalent to focus on this distinguished subalgebra within the semigroup.
Am I remembering something wrong, or is there also a second distinguished subalgebra, A tensor identity?
That's the why this is distinguished is because your noiseless part is encoded on HB. So if we decided to encode everything on HA, then that would be the distinguished algebra. What do you say?
Why isn't the group pointed at semigroup?
It's operators, right? You've got so a semigroup is basically a group with the inverse of this. Groups are semigroups.
This includes zero.
So if the identity is in there, then it's a monoid. Yes. So a monoid is a semigroup with an identity. Yeah.
A semigroup, you just mean it's closed under multiplication.
Yeah. It's easier to say semigroup.
Not literally, you have to think what it means.
Okay. Good. Good. Yeah, Monoid, I boycotted that term. So, I suppose that I should have turned this off. Should be on the internet. Okay, so remember back to the condition from the standard model, Neil de Flam, Bennett, Vincenzo, Smolin, Wooters condition. that generalizes to this more general setting, okay? And so now you have to keep track of, there's more things going on, right? You don't just have that that projection on your code subspace. You have this whole family of matrix units around, okay? But it turns out that this is the condition that characterizes things in the sense that if you have a correctable code, then if you do have a correctable code, then there always exists scalars. So it's two more indices now, so it's a much bigger scalar matrix. Nonetheless, it's a checkable condition. PKK, so think back to the 2x2 case, right? P11 was the identity in the 1-1 position, 0, 0, 0. P22 was the identity in the 2-2 position, then 0, 0 or else. And for instance, in that case, P12 would be the identity in the 1-2 position, then 0, 0 or else, right? And anyway, so you've got these conditions there that you can check that have to be satisfied just to be a correctable code. Now notice it's not an if and only if, and so that sort of bugs me as a mathematician, but we can go backwards with an extra technical assumption, okay? So if in other words, if there is a scalar matrix such that this condition holds and the scalars satisfy these conditions, then you can actually go and build in a constructive way, you can build your correction operation, okay? So it's an extra, it's an open question, I mean, is this necessary to go back the other way? It looks technical, but there is a very natural classic example that's satisfied, okay? Anyway, it's at first glance, it's just a technical condition, but it seems to have some meaning to it. Okay, so one important point that sort of a simple simple observation, but somehow it's saying something profound, that if you go back to that condition, excuse me, and you set. So remember this condition, this holds for anything, like anything in operator quantum error correction, including noisy subsystems, decongruent subspaces, and generalized noisy subspaces, all that stuff. That condition, if you set k equal to L there, what you're really looking at is a standard code subspace. Right? You have the condition from the standard model. And when you look at that, okay, so you get the standard model. So in other words, what that's saying is, for to have a correctable code in any of these schemes, you have to have a correctable code in the standard model sense. And so that condition from the standard model somehow becomes more important now. It was already important, I guess, but this shows that that it's actually necessary in this sort of generalized setting. Okay. All right, so the conclusion then, so operator quantum error correction, again, we're calling it that because the correctable code is the form of algebras and semigroups of operators. And so it's a scheme for error correction of quantum operations. It includes the standard model, standard noisy subsystems and decoherence-free subspaces. And it also includes this generalized version of noisy subsystems that important point, it applies to arbitrary quantum operations, not necessarily unital. And so there, we've obtained to this point a number of nice conditions, I think, that characterize or describe correctability and noisy subsystems, these sorts of things in this setting. And something that drops out of that analysis is that this condition from the standard model is necessary for all these things. And that's it. So this is. So we have a paper that just appeared in PRL, and there's another paper that just went on the archive a little while ago. So that's it.
Questions? Comments? Questions?
So, sorry, I want to get back to this question of the generalized versus the regular kind of the subsystem, noiseless subsystem.
Right.
So, my I guess standard toy conceptual model for the noiseless subsystems is you have some qubits that have errors and some qubits that don't have errors. And so what you're saying is that the usual definition, so first of all, there's the noiseless subspace, the coherence-free subspace, where the qubits with errors have to actually remain fixed under the noise.
Right.
And the noise subsystem, you're saying they don't have to remain fixed, but it has to be unital.
So you're talking in the standard. In the standard setting, well, it doesn't have to be, but sort of the general, I mean, most of the examples looked at there, if you look through literature, like collective rotation channels, for instance, they are unital. And it turns out in that case that the fixed point set for the channel is equal to the noise commutant. So it's not an accident that people were looking at the noise commutant. It actually equals the set of fixed points. In this general setting, though, I think I think of it in terms of equations, but that's maybe not what you want to hear. But the point is that maybe a natural physical example is when you're when you have like a standard noiseless subsystem as part of a composite system, and your channel is and your quantum operation is like in the classic examples I gave, like it's E1 tensor E2, where you've got a standard noiseless subsystem on your second system. But on the first system, you don't know what's going on. You can still talk about it in this context because it's, as long as it's noiseless on that second tensor slot, you can talk about it in this context, right? Because on the first, what this generalized notion allows is anything to happen on the first one, mm-hmm. the first tensor. Whereas if you like, in the decoherence-free, maybe it's better to think of the standard noiseless subsystem situation. What you're looking at really there is something in the algebra, and it's going to be of the form, because of the decomposition theory of C-star algebras, it's going to be of the form identity tensor sigma. And to be in the fixed point set means that thing has to go to identity tensor sigma. Whereas here what we're saying is that identity tensor sigma could go to, you know, tau tensor sigma.
Right.
Or more generally, sigma naught tensor sigma could go to,
Here you're talking about what happened. Well, you are given an error, so you know the error and you want to correct it. So what about error detection?
Right. Yeah. So there is in the standard model there is a type description of detection. You can just write down detection. In this setting, that's something actually we didn't look at yet, but I would imagine that there it should be generalized. Yeah, I mean, you should be able to generalize the condition for a detection. Yeah, that's something we didn't really look at in any sort of depth.
Have you given some? I mean, this is to do with errors, but obviously the reason you want to correct errors is because you're doing a computation. So that would mean you would have some operations taking place on this noiseless subsystem, a subspace in the usual case. But here you have this much more general idea of what a noiseless subsystem or code is, which is the semigroup. So have you given some thought to how you would do computations on the semigroup? You know, maps of this. What would the computation be if you some map of the semigroup into itself and something?
Right.
How would you implement such a
thing? So you mean like sort of a... I mean, quantum operations acting on the semigroup, or maybe just unitaries. Like if you're actually doing sort of, you're applying gates or something, is that what you're
saying? So your question is, what is the equivalent of factorized operations on these systems, for example? Rather than look at this.
Right.
Although you might not want to do computation, you want just to send this qubit to somebody.
Oh, but it's the best.
Yeah, so that's
right.
But this is
but I mean, it seems like you might have an idea.
Yeah,
or that's a real paradigm for quantum computation.
Yeah. Right, yeah, that's enticing. Yeah. I haven't thought about that.
Farah?
In the case of two qubit systems, is it possible to find a simple example which does not fit to this standard L-fraction code, but is described by your generalized
group? In a, okay, so the smallest non-trivial example, I guess, would be on a four-dimensional space.
So 2 qubits.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, 2 qubits, I guess, because you could just take that class of examples I had and have an arbitrary channel on the first qubit and it would have a noise, to be a non-trivial noise subsystem, I guess it would have to be at least two-dimensional, so it's kind of, that class would kind of give you trivial generalization in that case, but if it was so, in the three-qubit case, then you definitely have some classes that would fit in, into that class of examples.
So is it then so that the class of errors which you can collect is much wider if you allow for the generalized scheme?
I think so, on its face.
I still don't understand that. I mean, in this example where you have some of the qubits that have errors of whatever type, and the other ones are alone, I mean, clearly there's an error correction code there in the usual sense. You encode it, you have it. An error correcting code, you're saying a small subset, it's
smaller. Oh, sorry, yeah, okay.
A large number, and then decoding.
Right. Okay, so there's, yeah. So there's, it depends on what you're thinking of, I guess. Yeah, you're right. To have a correctable code in this context, the standard condition has to be satisfied.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So maybe that's the answer. That's the answer to your question. But it opens up new possibilities in the sense that there are places maybe where there are standard correctable codes there where you wouldn't have looked at before, because sort of for instance this perspective includes things like non-trivial corrections of algebras, right? Of algebras so a non-trivial correction of an algebra would on its face would goes beyond the standard model because it's an algebra and not a subspace. And if R is non-trivial, then it goes beyond the standard noise of subsystems. So, right? See what I mean? The condition from the standard model has to be satisfied all the time. But this perspective may open up open people's eyes to different places to look for correctable codes.
That's a good question. You mentioned that the standard error correction condition was necessary. But it would be necessary and sufficient if it's constructive, right?
Right. But remember this in this situation, you've got more. When there's more than one matrix unit, you've got the standard error correction just tells you when you compress those individual blocks. You've got standard correctable codes. That doesn't tell you how the algebra things in the full matrix algebra act together. Just mathematically, you can't splice together. You can't take what's going on those individual standard code subspaces and splice them together to build a correction for the whole thing. So that's part of the reason why that theorem is an if and only if. It's we need an extra, at least at this point, we need an extra technical condition for that.
Okay, so same shift, again.
It's a couple of words.
It's either 32 by 2.
Yeah, I don't think it's